meeting of Parliament, Wednesday, the 8th of July, 2020. Order of proceedings. Answers to oral questions. Continued. Question number 377 of 2020. The Honourable R.M. Clinton. Mr. Speaker, how many times has the relocation of Mount Alvernia or the outsourcing of operations?
Speaker, I want this question to be from 382 to 386.
Runway improvements work continue at Mount Alvernia to bring the residential home to the same standard as the John Mack home and hillside. Did the Honourable Minister not say he wanted to do three questions from short? Sorry. When will the tourist home reopen? How soon does government expect to repatriate back to the Cochrane Ward of St Bernard Hospital the elderly residents who were temporarily, as a consequence of the COVID crisis, housed at Mount Alvernia?
Answer, the Old Minister for Health and Care.
Mr. Speaker, there are no plans to relocate Mount Alvernia or outsource operations, but improvement work at Mount Alvernia will resume after the ERS COVID-19 restoration program is complete. The transfer of residents from Mount Alvernia to St. Bernard's Hospital took place on the 5th of July. In relation to the reopening of the Jewish home, it is not possible to provide a date at this time, as works have been delayed by the total economic shutdown arising from the pandemic. We want to see this facility reopened as soon as possible, and we continue to work with the managing board of the Jewish community towards this important and overdue objective.
Regarding the Honourable Minister's answers about Mount Alvernia and the refurb there, does government have a plan to carry out these works efficiently and successfully while the residents still live there, and if so, could it share its strategy or its plan for the refurbishment with the side of the house?
Yes, thank you.
Within the plan for refurbishment and the agenda for the refurb, does government acknowledge that much of that, as well as being sort of the hardware work, will a lot of the refurb go towards helping patients with dementia and Alzheimer's? Because it is the oldest care home in Gibraltar, so it's not dementia friendly like the others, so I'm not just asking about like improvement in terms of refurb, but will it have a dementia and Alzheimer's sort of friendly design in order to bring it up to standard with the other ones do?
Mr. Speaker, I think you've already announced that that is the case, and that the refurbishment, as we have already said publicly, will be to upgrade Mount Alvernia to the style and design that was the subject of the Honourable Lady's extensive consultation at the time that she was the Minister with responsibility, and which saw the former St Bernard, John Mack Wing as it's known, prepared for this purpose, and it was also the design that was followed as the dementia facility, and this is including know, color coding, etc. And that is what is being undertaken at Mount Aurelia, as we have already announced in the case. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can we just advise about how long the British Club has been closed? People come to an exact date to the business of that question for the years. I guess this is just a form, I appreciate it. Most of them may not have the information to hand, but certainly it would appear, at least in the memory, several years at least. Could you advise, obviously, pre COVID, why in his view it's taking so long to refurbish the material? Well, Mr. Speaker, as I have said already, I believe in this House in an earlier occasion, because of changes of plans relating to what was going to be entailed in the refurbishment. The ultra term was not fit for purpose when we took over. There were issues with the wiring, which required refurbishment simply back to the grip, and then it could be able to do it back. We consulted widely with the president of the Jewish community, with the members of the Jewish community who have responsibility for the Jewish home, and we looked at many different options for refurbishment. That is what has entailed the delay of the very many different options that we have looked at. We have now, because of our own view about how long it is taking and their view about how long it's taking and they're wanting to refurbish, settled on a plan, and having settled on a plan, we're able to proceed. Question number three. The minister also recalled that the GST raised a PR having been approached by a number of families in relation to that move. And shortly thereafter, we recalled that there had been a move of these residents back to the Cotton Board. But what we gathered from our engagement with the families of the relatives that were moved throughout the COVID pandemic was that ultimately the objective should be, of course, for a specific residents for these individuals rather than being based within the hospital. And I was wondering whether the minister had any information as to what the long-term plan is for those residents. And although they feel that the hospital is a home for them insofar as access to their families and relatives, and I feel very strongly about that from the information I'm receiving, I wonder what the long-term objective of the government is insofar as those specific residents based in the hospital is. Well, Mr. Speaker, I think the Ombudsman has got the wrong end of the stick here. As I understand it, as we've demonstrated during the COVID period, we're able to accommodate everyone in an area which is not the hospital. The issue is that I use the word convenience in the widest possible sense. It is in the interest of some families to have relatives in that area. It is not necessarily in the interest of your relatives to be in that area. But we recognise that one of the advantages for those who are residents of PRS is to have their relatives able to visit them. And in some instances, it is not so easy to visit relatives in other locations for those who have their own mobility issues. But there would be no difficulty with them all being housed, as we demonstrated in the COVID emergency period, that we could house them all in the area of Mount Aurelia and the other homes that have their own.
If I may, I don't think I've got an answer to the question about whether a resident should be staying in the home whilst the refurbishments were done. And also, can I have some details on the level of refurbishment? We're talking about everything, bathrooms, bathroom floors, and again, where were the patients to, where were the residents to during this project?
Dementia or friends by use of calculating and timing, etc. So the intention is that it is necessary to move residents from one area to the other, obviously that will happen. We won't be painting walls around the patient while they're sitting in their respective bedrooms.
Do you have
any idea when patients would be moved
during such a significant project?
Because there is still capacity in the Mount Avon, and it is not, in fact, during COVID, what we have done is we have to make use of the area with the communal areas, like the cafeteria, the restaurant, and also the space of their area. Actually house patients and provide them with sleeping accommodation within those floors. And it is necessary to use these areas in such a manner because these works won't be removed for the time being. We will find ways to be able to accommodate patients in other areas while consistent works can be done, and we can bring the level of marginal to high standards.
Question number 378 of 2020. The Honourable D.A. Beacon. Mr. Speaker, is it the government policy that patients referred by the VHA for treatment in Spain and who receive local medical treatment at the hands of Spanish medical institutions or doctors should be left with no alternative but to see Spain? Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and Care.
Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Speaker, on the 23rd of October, I wrote to the Honourable Minister about a constituent that had come to see me who was referred to a hospital in Spain for an operation of his right kidney. And he went to the hospital in Spain and he was operated on both his left and his right kidney, which is the clearest case of gross negligence. I went to him on the 8th of January, on the 13th of February, on the 12th of March, and then on the 26th of May, I received a letter from a firm of solicitors, which was addressed to me here in Parliament, and said that my client, because I had written on parliamentary letterhead to the Honourable Gentleman, and the Honourable Gentleman knew that I was dealing with this because it was a constituent, to essentially send me a letter from the Spain saying the hospital is closed. This is the most inappropriate way to be dealing with a member of the public in debate. The Honourable Gentleman said that he was dealing with a constituent, but then he set out his position that he were dealing with a client. Without having the sight of the letter that he says he has received, I do know that I won't take it from him, but it says what he suggests it says, and he might be kind enough to provide a copy. The position of the government is that if a patient is in the care of the Gibraltar Health Authority, and there is an issue of negligence in respect of that patient, it is the Gibraltar Health Authority that is in the frame in respect of any action that that individual may take. Whether or not the Gibraltar Health Authority then takes action, also to join an entity from outside or inside Gibraltar that may have been involved in the care of the individual. So, Mr. Speaker, that is the position of the government. The government remains responsible for the care through the VHA of any individual who, under the good practice medical scheme or under the contributions that they make under the Patient Insurance General, is entitled to care by the VHA, who suffers as a result result of negligence or believe that they happen to be the result of negligence, is able to commence proceedings against the Jehovah's Witness authorities, so the Jehovah's Witness authorities are seeking a contribution or to join any third party that may be relevant. But without seeing the records of the Honourable Gentleman in the first place, as you know, I don't take for granted anything that is relevant or any of his interpretations as to what it is that the document may or may not say. I have to say that the idea that I would attempt to counter the Parliament as referring to a letter from a former war to three parliamentarians that I would have to represent the opposition is fanciful to the minister. I am going to send it to the Honourable Chief Minister in a moment via WhatsApp because I have it via WhatsApp. But in fact, this letter says the following. Following our preliminary investigation, our view is that the VHA made a referral to an appropriate hospital, namely Leon Hospital, and mentioned in the New South Wales, in a proper manner and at the appropriate time. Hence, in our opinion, there are no grounds upon which a claim of negligence can be made against the VHA. The circumstances kindly suggest that your client, the referral, I've never looked to the Honourable Minister, who knows, as a matter of fact, which is a lawyer, I wrote to him to the parliamentary letterhead. Your client direct their potential claim to the wrong hospital's name, Mr. Speaker. That is how I am at least gratified that the Honourable Chief Minister has set out what the government's position is, that the government remains responsible because the government was first, and that is the reason to be this case. And then we are now, the Honourable Minister, in the light of what the Honourable Chief Minister has said to Parliament today, could we get a substantive response to the letter that I sent to him on the 23rd of October, which I sent to him on the 8th of January, 13th of February, 12th of March, properly investigating the circumstances of this case, and if this gentleman has, as he says, been operated on both kidneys, the one that needs to be operated on, and the other kidney, that is a matter that is taken up with you on, and it is a liability that is dealt with in relation to this poor chap that is obviously suffering, the first the consequence of being operated in the wrong kidney. I'm grateful for the Honourable Gentleman having read. I don't know whether it's the letter or otherwise from the letter. He hasn't sent it to me yet. I wonder why. But I'd like to receive it before I'm able to deal with it. But what's very clear, Mr. Speaker, is that the Honourable Gentleman asked us about what the government view of the liability was. That is the government view of the liability, as I set out before. What he also knows is that the JJ is insured, and that the government is not able, without initiating the terms of the insurance, which I'm sure is not something that he would invite us to do, and indeed is the learned leader, his learned leader, having been a minister for health before, will know that we have to be very careful when we address issues of liability in the VOK because of matters relating to insurance. Now, because somebody has been dealt with in a way that is negligent or potentially negligent, that is a matter that has to be dealt with in the circumstances where it's been out, it has to be investigated and it has to be addressed. And that is done through insurance. So, Mr. Speaker, if you are with anyone that we have the letter, once I've perceived it, once I've perused it, perhaps you and I can have a further discussion about this case, because if the circumstances are as he suggests, then I might have agreed with him, if they are not, and they're not always as he suggests. Even when we look at the same document, he might tend to have a different sort of opinion as to what it is that it says, then he might have to reconsider his approach in respect of this particular case. But I'm very interested to know what has happened in this case on the basis of what he has set out. And I can assure his constituent, who is also my constituent, that I will be looking into this matter if we're anywhere near the sort of case that he has indicated. Well, I am very grateful to the Honourable Chief Minister to Barb Desai, which is the President of the direct Barb in our direction, even when he is giving a helpful message to the instructions to the Honourable. He did catch me by surprise with the letter that came from these lawyers, and I am aware that, of course, when we have received instructions from the insurance company, that allow terrible detriment of being on the opposite side of the very sensitive. This practice is a very practical way of looking at it. And in fact, I think the thing we go to on that basis was to people the sensitive, ask Dr. Awal to investigate the facts of the matter. But I would assume that was the condition in one of the emails from the Honourable Gentleman's office, as well as Dr. Whitaker's of the surprise. And if necessary, he would engage lawyers, and if the issue of liability was clear, then he would simply deal with it without the need for either me or anybody else elevating the issue to the House, or publicly, or causing unnecessary distress to members of the public. The only reason why I wrote it, I have to say, is because the Honourable Gentleman, unfortunately, has not responded to the email that was the correspondence that I sent, and therefore I'm going to phrase it in terms of a question that the Honourable Gentleman did not agree with me, that is not the correct way of not only treating a parliamentary colleague, but also a constituent. Well, Peter, of course I'm going to do it, and for a simple reason. You see, he says that even when I'm trying to be helpful, I erase my answer from France. It's that in trying to be helpful, I decide not to take him on the program, because what he was trying to do is to cast a person on one particular minister for health by trying to cast praise on another. Of course, if the other was still the minister for health, he would have cast a person on him, despite their declared friendship of Jim Buddy, tried to pretend that the earlier one was better. Because the other thing is doing what he's always done, he's playing politics, and in that system, in particular, he's playing politics with someone's life. If that has been a case of negligence, let's deal with it. What is to say, Mr. Speaker, that the matter has not been dealt with as the Honourable Gentleman suggests? In other words, that there has been a delay, of course, if we just simply look at the dates that he has set out, he might have been, there has been. But we don't know in the other instances that the minister who's been praised, who I happen to have the highest regard for as well, as much as I do for Dr. Bates, who's also been for the health, and Mr. O'Reilly, who is now in for the health, having asked somebody to look into it, might have taken some time to look into it, because these are not easy matters, they are complex matters, and so he might still have been referring to the same period of time to have people who say it's so praiseworthy provide in the he said it's so magnificent, exactly the same answer in exactly the same period. If he was genuinely concerned about these things, if he were really trying to pursue a solution for a constituent, and not trying to do that was standing feet and both in respect of everything that may cross the state. I think even eating his conflict in the morning, he had a political element in it, but something which I fully respect him. He would have picked up the phone and called me. He would have said, I'm having a genuine difficulty in respect of somebody who's had a genuine problem, and I'm not getting a response, don't call as I used to get from me. Can you help? Of course, that would have been pursuing this matter genuinely in the interest of our common constituents. Instead, here comes the chance to answer dark, Roger Dart, and try for a political point, which is exactly what we would expect him to do now. If you are serious about trying to deal with the problem that this lady or gentleman may have had, then please let it investigate it, and let it not pretend that one minister for health is better than another, that that has an effect or a consequence in respect of a response. And let's look at the substance of the issue, because the position of the government in respect of this decision is to deal with the problem the Honourable Gentleman says he has identified. And if there is a problem of negligence, or if there is another type of problem, we must address it, because that is what we are here to ensure that we provide for the taxpayer the best possible system, the best possible service, and in particular, the best possible health service. So I would suggest to Mr. Speaker that he leave that benefit of denying for the next, the one who spent so long trying to become leader of the party that he said he vowed to ensure would disappear. And he did that thing, the benefit of it was for that short period, when it appeared that his ambition had been stated enough, who covered in tears the response he gave to the attractive job that Noble Lady did up to him here in this house, that still didn't really the leadership of the party, he didn't give it to her and to somebody else, his Don Lamont, something that I'd always thought would have been attributed ideas trying to bring it about. And that panel can then help me and help this principal to resolve the issue that his constituents, our constituents, his colleagues' constituents say he has had. That, I think, is a bigger incentive than the people who are specific attitudes that we are trying to bring to the House in prosecuting this matter in the way that he is doing. I must say to him that he's obviously not especially the best role that he is a prosecutor, but obviously he's a professional protester. I am very grateful to get into the system that we are for the peace provided. I have to say that one of the main United Terrorist attacks was
the management team at Dr. Zuwaldi has not been informed of any such transport-related issues, but in any event, normal public bus services have now resumed.
Services, but I was told in the last few days that despite the resuming of the bus services, some Minister for Transport to perhaps review the current buses and maybe have a chat with me in order so that I can present him further issues that some of these employees are facing, given their importance within the workforce at this time.
The answer is that we have to be on the next conference to the end of the session to the question.
Next question. Question number 285 of 2020. The end is MD Hassan now.
What is the number of people living with dementia in Gibraltar?
Answer. On the Minister for Health and Care.
If you don't want to speak to the question 385, 286, 292, 292.
Question number 386 of 2020.
What is the number of people living with dementia in Gibraltar receiving domiciliary care?
Question number 387 of 2020.
What is the number of people living with dementia in Gibraltar waiting for a bed in residential care?
Question number 388 of 2020. The Honourable Mackenzie Hassan Naun.
Is the government carrying out a study on the prevalence of people living with dementia in Gibraltar in the next 5 to 10 years?
Question number 389 of 2020. The Honourable Mackenzie Hassan Naun.
When will the government establish and select the National Dementia Committee?
Question number 390 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Naun.
When will the government appoint a Dementia Coordinator and Dementia Liaison Manager?
Answer. The Honourable the Minister for Health and Care.
Speaker, as of December 2019, there were 410 individuals diagnosed as living with dementia. At present, there are 152 individuals living with dementia receiving domiciliary care. There are currently 30 individuals living with dementia on the ERS waiting list. The Speaker of Unitary is in the process of conducting a study into the incidence of dementia by analysing the annual prevalence of this condition. The National Dementia Commission is already established. And in relation to question 100, this has currently been reviewed and announcement will be made in due course.
If I may, can I ask the Minister the announcement for what is that? Because I've got many questions and I didn't get what announcement he was talking about.
Mr. Speaker, I was referring to question 390, which said, will the government appoint the Dementia Coordinator and the Dementia Liaison Manager?
If I can start from the supplementary. From what I understand, the Minister, when he talks about the number of people living with dementia, he says 410, I believe, as from that 2019. And from what I understand, the last official figures are 2018. Is this an official update of 2019? And if so, is it, has it been made public? And maybe I haven't seen it, but As far as
our research goes, 2018 is the last official figure. Yes, we hope that these are the official figures. These are the ones I asked my staff to provide me.
Mr. Speaker, with regards to supplementary and question 386, can I ask how does the Minister know how many of those within the community with dementia are not receiving the care? Because he say there are 152 receiving cells, so are we talking about basically the difference to 250 or 250? Are there 250 people in the community not receiving care? Because knowing the stats are important to plan for the future, from care and funding into the next 5 years. Knowing how many people there are in the early stages, does government have a grip on how many people there are with dementia in the community? Suffering from dementia, living with dementia in the early stages.
Because I read the statistics correctly, of the 410 individuals diagnosed as living with dementia, some of those will be living at home, and some will be living within ERS. And the figure states that how many people are receiving domestic care, and that would mean that they receive this care at home.
Does government have a department or a group of employees within the health service, within the ministry, to monitor the amount of people living within the community and developing symptoms? Is it sort of on top of those on the outside of the actual ERS system who are sort of coming along with dementia from early symptoms?
We think that patient testing, by the way, with the respective GPs, and with his diagnosis, the dimension of dementia is diagnosed or is suspected, they need to be referred to the care of Dr. Antonio Marin, who does a full investigation and asks him what type of dementia the patient is suffering from, and then plans a treatment for that patient.
The minister said in Rabbit Question 390 that there will be appointing a dementia coordinator and dementia liaison manager in due course. But the National Dementia Commission has already been established. In the strategy that's already been established in page 6.2, it recognizes the importance of a dementia coordinator and a manager. So this is a key objective for strategy. So how long are we supposed to be waiting for these appointments? Because it seems clear from the strategy itself that the dementia plan cannot continue without these managers and coordinators. How long is in due course?
It is government's opinion that it is extremely important to have a dementia coordinator. And the reason why this has not happened yet was because the post was going to be presented at the estimate submissions this year. Because it's been a delay to the financial year, this will be presented in the year. So this will happen, and we will be presenting the department and for the approval of all the members.
But Stephen, is this also applying generally to the committee? Because the minister said that it has already been set up, but it doesn't seem like there's a structure for it, or it doesn't seem like people have been selected, it doesn't seem like it's been established, and I certainly know that it has never met. So is this as well something that will take place in due course, so that we can establish the entire plan and move forward, or is there
are
these elements of the committee going to be waiting for a date that hasn't been
established yet? Absolutely, Mr. Speaker. In fact, it was back in January when the actual dementia committee was made public. But it did not get the names of those to be appointed was made public, because as different people move in and out of their respective roles, the names of individuals kind of change. But what was made public in January that the dementia committee would be constituted of, for example, the principal secretary for mental health and care, a national dementia coordinator, which is what we alluded to in the previous supplementary, the ERS manager, the president, the CEO, the UK medical director, I demand that, etc. So there are a list which is set in January of all those officials that would be part of that, for that visit, and also further health departments which would be required to attend. And if you haven't seen it, it's so widespread and so important throughout the whole community that people, for example, like the police commissioner, the tourism CEO, director of environment, and numerous others, would also form part of this dementia committee. And as to when it is expected that this will start, we are expecting it to happen sometime within the last quarter of this year.
Next question. Can I just ask before the meeting is finished, and a question for you to take is a question on the government can have a stone in the prevalence of people living with dementia and disease in the next 5 to 10 years. The answer, I think, of one of the minister was that the DHA is coming out to study already. Can I ask him how is this study being carried out? Is this an independent study? Is it an in-house study? And how is the study being carried out on the prevalence of people? Because presumably, it's not dealing with the people who already have the disease. It's sort of forecasting, which is, I think, one of the ladies' questions, forecasting how many people will have dementia or trying to treat in a helpful way, the likelihood of the trend of dementia diagnosis and devotion for the forthcoming future. So how is this in practice happening if this is already ongoing? What's the scope of this study? Is there an attempt to interview or assess individuals once they reach a certain age or once they display certain symptoms? Perhaps an older member can illuminate us on that.
Ms. Cooper, in 2019, in fact, the clinical director for the elderly prepared an end of year report which analyzes the actual prevalence, the annual prevalence of dementia, both in the community and within the residential settings. So, some of that is an internal document which lays out the prevalence of dementia. In fact, the last report was carried out in 2019 showed that. Within the whole community, there's about 1.7% to 1.17% of the older population, and within the over 65-year-old bracket, around 8.5% of all those over the age of 65 are suffering from dementia. And these are the statistics that come about from this end of year report we have been having since 2018, carried out by the clinical director for the elderly.
I'm grateful for that, but I'm not sure that answers the question, because that simply is saying there is a report already happening, which is an internal nature, there's a lot commissioned to a sort of external specialist. And that internal report is looking at actual statistics now, making it proportional to the population and therefore coming up with these figures of 1.1%, 1.7% of the overall population, 8.5% of over 65, which is, I think, the only number said. But the question asks, what study are you doing on the prevalence going forward for the next 5 to 10 years? So it's a much more forward-looking question. Is the DHA, in the answer that you originally gave, is that you were carrying out the study? If the DHA is carrying out the study, looking at future trends and how to deal with it, or is it simply carrying out this internal study, which is an after-the-event correlation of the statistics to the population? And speak up, this study is what will give an indication of what might come. The other gentleman says, but what are we doing about the prevalence in the future? That is inherently contradictory, because prevalence is about existence. So the definition of prevalence is about the factual condition of being. So what the other gentleman is, I think, trying to say, and on which we agree, is that we need to be making an assessment of how we expect in advertising in the future. In order to do that, what we are doing is the study that the algorithm has been referred to, which gives us an indication of the rate today so that we can extrapolate forward. There is no other way that we are advised available for us to be able to do this, other than just foretelling. So it's by looking at the statistics we are today and the trends that are developing that we will be able to extrapolate them forward. To achieve what I think the algorithm agrees with us, we should be trying to do, which is why we're doing it, which is to make an assessment of what resources we're going to need or how we might better approach the reporting, treatment, although that one unfortunately is not one with the study in respect of this disease that we would all like to see, and the care that we provide for those with this disease. So, Mr. Speaker, I think we rather than only see that what we are doing is designed to give us to that understanding of the ancient prevalence of this disease. In our community, so that we have better people to deal with it as best we can, which I'm sure that we all agree we need to be able to do. Mr. Speaker, yes, I think we are on common ground as to what the objective should be, but there is no element of contradiction in the way I put my question, because I was simply reflecting, which is not my question, but in answer to this question, which is about the presence in the future, the honourable member. His original answer was that the UK can have this study, so I just want to probe as to how this is in fact going to happen. Do you think that the original answer was that we can have this study in relation to the prevalence of people living with dementia in the past 2 years? And what is obvious from the answer that has been given is that in fact what is happening is that these are snapshots after the event, if I can put it that way, of what is happening today, the status. Trends, historical trends, which will help for the future, actually how to deal with the dementia, which I certainly think is the right thing to do as well, but in terms of perhaps looking at support or other mechanisms which can assist in relation to how these trends are developing, and does the government agree that it might be helpful, given that the Honourable Minister has indicated that this is an internal document, and that this is part of the story that external specialists might be commissioned to assist the UN status now. Well, Mr. Speaker, I really strongly don't think this is an issue of party politics. I think this is an issue that cuts across this community. And the political divide and the real difference in the approach of the political parties in this respect. So the answer to that sort of question, if it were put on the basis of a yes or no answer being required, is yes, insofar as that is considered to be necessary by those in the GHA who are the specialists. But from the understanding that we have, there is unfortunately no expertise unavailable to the GHA personnel in working with individuals within the organisation of the GHA and working within what I might call the socio-charitable medical fraternity in Gibraltar, which means that we don't have access to particular expertise in doing those extrapolations and looking at those trends, which in theory are almost critical factors, but unfortunately it would appear from what we are being advised, there is no other mechanism in place that is available elsewhere which we are not accessing, either because we are seeking to save cash, we are seeking to save space, or we are seeking to act in any other way. And we really wanted to seek access to whatever it is that may be available that may help us to better allocate resources, treat, I use that word again, advisedly, unfortunately, provide care in respect of those who are critically suffering with dementia, those who may start the process of suffering with dementia, and those who in the future may suffer with dementia, and to ensure that we have the resources available to deal with those undersuffering who may develop. So the algorithm can rest assured that the government has already taken the approach of not wanting to simply look at what it is that we may do here, but look more widely at what it is that we might be able to do generally in the effect of this disease. And if anything comes to visitors, like fears or wonders whether we have explored, then you should feel free to get in touch with me or with the minister so that we can ensure that that particular rock has been lifted and we've refunded, and if not, we certainly will.
Considering that the committee hasn't started yet or been established and the strategy hasn't been implemented in full, would the minister or the chief minister agree that the strategy has to be wholly implemented in order to ascertain certain types of information that not having implemented the committee yet, especially as recommended in the first point of the key objective within the strategy, would actually come to the integrity of such a study and make it non-viable as it stands?
Not the one of the first few things, but nobody knows that we've been through 4 months where, unfortunately, normal service has not been able to be resumed until recently, and even then, not entirely. But she is encouraging us to do that which we are committed to doing and which we have not yet been able to do. And the figure, do we wish that we were back in February or early March and doing these things rather than doing some of the things that we have to do? Absolutely. I'm sure that she agrees with me in that respect, and that this community will be best served when we're able to take those steps and finalise this important strategy on which we are embarked.
Next question, I think that's Warren.
Question number 225 of 2020. The Honourable E.J. Phillips.
The current government confirmed that it is now decommissioning all of the old people's power generation plants.
Answer: the Honourable the Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
This is the only old people's power generation plant being commissioned is Waterford Power Station. It is being used only on standby basis.
The standby basis, is that a permanent status?
Permanent status.
Yes, but the reason why it's not a general matter, quite frankly, but anyway, let's get on with the supplementary. The page 51 of the supplementary manifesto says that the commissioning of the plant will take place at the end of 2019. I'm just wondering why there is a 6 month delay in that decommissioning.
I'm not sure whether the Honourable Member has been in the last 4 months, but certain things have happened in the last 4 months which have not allowed us to progress things as we would have. Before we fully decommission the plant and standby basis, simply it is there. So standby does not have to be used. There is no power being generated by this particular plant at the moment. It is just there on standby if it is needed. We are in the process of finally and fully commissioning Waterford Renewal, our North Node power station, and that will be subject to some delays in terms of the full testing program. The tests which were being carried out earlier this year, and which need to continue, were almost put on hold in the last 4 months just to make sure that we continue to have the resilience that we needed. In terms of power generation, and it was not disrupted by the testing process. And it was also the affordable technicians being available in Gibraltar. So the final and full commissioning of the North Node Power Station has still not been completed. I expect Waterford Power Station to be decommissioned. I hope the Honourable Member won't tell me to it, although I assume that he will. By the end of this year, that will be fully committed. But we need to be satisfied that by the time we do that, we then need to have something on standby in case we ever need it. And therefore, we need to be satisfied that the North Coast Power Station is completely up to speed. It is running normally. All the necessary testing has been carried out. I would add, I'm sure the Honourable Member will be interested, that the North Coast Power Station, is, as the Honourable Member knows, is gas. And what the last one can do is that it is running on gas. All the
countries are capable of running on gas and typically run on gas. And that is now responsible for around 80% of power consumption in the world. So 80% of all power being consumed in the world at the moment is being generated by gas power generators rather than diesel power generators. I hope the other one will welcome that.
Next question. Question number 326 of 2020. The Honourable E.J. Phillips.
The Canada government states how many kilowatt hours of electricity have been produced and fed into the power network and solar panels at New Harbours and Europa Business Centre.
Answer. The Honourable for Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
Speaker, the Europa Business Centre solar installation is not yet operational. The New Harbours installation has up until the end of May generated a total of 1,419,666 kilowatt hours.
Does the Minister know what that means for the grid and the total energy use for our community of the power generated by New Harbours?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it means for the grid itself. I assume that it will be fed into the grid, but it means that it is generating, or its capacity is 800 kilowatts. That's the generating capacity of the New Harbour installation, which has been finalized.
The reason why I asked that question, of course, is that the plan was a ridiculous international economic plan that it took the electorate for the last general election envisaged a very significant investment in relation to solar parks, namely 20,000 square metres, to deliver 3.5 megawatts of power, amounting to, as is said in the manifesto, 10% of Gibraltar's total electricity power. To our community. Clearly, the amount of 800 kilowatts is obviously woefully below the target, which is considering the fact that this is not even started yet. How does the government envisage rolling out this proposal put forward in its manifesto in terms of meeting that standard of 10% of electricity power in our community?
That the honourable member has asked about two specific projects, New Harbours and Europa Business Centre. But that is, of course, not the full story. There have been a number of press releases issued setting out areas where the government has identified and embarked on projects. I could give the honourable member the list of the rest of the nation, Special Olympic, Lansbury, and Europa Point, that's a very facility. New Harbours Estate, Europa Business Centre, Mid Harbours Estate, Airport, Mount Albania, Ocean Views and Hillside Centre, St. Joseph's School, University of Houston, the one the accommodation at the other of the University itself, and the cruise liner terminal. All of these projects are being carried out at the moment, all in 2020. All of these projects, when they come to fruition, will have the capacity to generate around 4.6 megawatts of electricity, and that represents 16% of Gibraltar's generating need, which is 6% higher than the target which the other member has referred to.
I think that's it would be helpful. To have that listed in the glossy pictures of the manifesto, which we're going to set every single month that we come here for the people of Gibraltar, so that they can understand what promises will be broken during the course of the next 4 years of the Speaker. But what we would say, Mr. Speaker, is on that basis, on the basis, on the order, on the order. Mr. Speaker, the order becomes what? This is not possible in the broadcast. I mean, we want to do that. Well, we
really are very happy to pray, but can you just accept that what he has identified is not a promise in Greek, but a promise actually delivered?
Thank you.
And the best is the best film just a few months ago with the list to both sides of the house.
And this is if I'm grateful for the clarification, what I would say though, just for the record, is that I believe the points that I'm making are entirely clear, we're entirely civil, we're not provocative, and we're entirely proper with the greatest respect to the speaker. I in no way consider them to be improper or provocative. In fact, what I'm doing is I'm going to attempt to
the Honourable Minister of Education, Employment, Utilities and Sport. The extension jetty was originally used by the MOD to discharge fuel into King's Lynn Depot and also as a refueling station following construction in 1955. After the jetty was taken over by the government in the early 1990s, it was operated as a bunker berth primarily for super yachts and coasters. The intention of the government is to continue for our successes to take bunkers at this location.
Question number 228 of 2020. The Honourable E.J. Reyes.
to speak about, can government provide details of the school's calendar for the academic year 2020-2021? So that too, along the date for each term, but together with details of holidays during any term time period and in service days.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
A copy of the school calendar for the academic year 2020-2021 is now handed to the Honourable Member. And whilst the Honourable Member receives that, I can clarify the question I spoke about in service dates. And as the Honourable Member will be familiar, these are dates which are arranged by the Department of Education with the schools during the course of the year, and different schools having it in different dates. So therefore, the calendar itself will not set the dates themselves. This is a matter of ongoing process between the Department of Education and the schools. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I look at that now. The reason why I asked as well as regular service dates is because I think there was some talk, I don't know whether we can get this from the teacher side or from the ministry side, of perhaps schools from different sectors, lower primary, upper primary, all coming together to have a specific more global type of service, and therefore schools in the sector might all be closed at the same time. But I do understand what the minister said. It really is up to each school to negotiate, if one wants to use that word, with the director of education, especially if you have some external personnel, expert education experts coming in to deliver. So I'm grateful for what I have. I have any supplementary, I will ask the speaker's permission to inquire further. Mr. Speaker, my understanding is that generally in service states are arranged between the school and the department by sector. So you would have an in-service state for the secondary sector, whereby the schools would do it, and the lower primary sector. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, but that is how I understand it. It normally works, and that's why I expect it happens at this rate.
Question number 329 of 2020. The Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Don't the government consider the use of modular construction methods for the comprehensive schools and the university comprehensive block?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
Those involved in this particular phase have decided to proceed down conventional route.
The previous way, when you say conventional route, we normal brick, mortar, concrete, and that was deemed to be better than modular. Is that right?
It's not a question whether it was deemed to be better or worse than modular. There was a process, and the result of that process was that the processes was that the contractor and the construction method proposed, which appeared to be both viable and best for the government and for the community of the taxpayer, was chosen.
Question number 2.
Thank you, Speaker. We're coming back to future deal because a couple of very minor points to be clear. The minister, in the note, says 24 hours of interest for staff development to be carried out in a different way to be determined by the education talk before. Those 24 hours, if we look at the number of days for
25 is 6 days, rather than 24 continuous hours, if it's 3 days or 8 hours each, because I am my deduction is that it's 3 days of service, but it refers to number of hours, or is it referring to the hours that, for example, after 4:30 or say after 3 in the afternoon, is it referring to that? People were certainly not referring to 24 continuous hours or putting service for the teachers. As the other member has identified that there is a 3 days between 2 days and staff days, there is also reference to 24 hours. That raises the possibility, but not necessarily the certainty, that those 24 hours will be done over those 3 days, 8 hours per day, so that there can be other permutations as to how those 24 hours are actually made. Apart from the 3 days. That is a matter that will be subject of ongoing consideration and discussion.
I'm very grateful for that we're going to put. So, what the minister is saying, although not caught in 4 years, it is possible that the equivalent of those 3 or 7 days could be carried out by using 24 hours over some other penetration in the course of the year. Is that what you're saying?
Together, 3 in-service days will be in-service days. So there are 3 in-service days. My understanding is that traditionally, in any in-service days, there's around 5 hours of in-service delivered, more or less. If it is used, if those 3 days are used as normal in-service days as they have been used in the past, that would amount to 15 hours, which would still require 9 hours to be done. There is a possibility of extending the number of hours on each of those 3 days, or finding some other permutation to do those other hours that is still connected to these finals.
Okay, I'll get to that. One other thing, Mr. Speaker, the note on the spring term holiday says that Commonwealth Day to be placed on the Monday that commences the spring midterm early, for example, in 2021, it will be the 15th of February. Does that mean that the bank holiday for the whole of Gibraltar will be transferred from March now to the Monday for a connecting system? Would you have that implication in the whole community of Gibraltar, not just the school?
The Commonwealth Day will be a bank holiday. It will be a bank holiday not just for the school, but for everybody working in the community. However, the member will see that what there is for the first time in the spring term is a new midterm, which happens in February, which is a week. So the decision, the policy decision was taken by the government because there was some flexibility on Commonwealth Day, rather than having Commonwealth Day passed at a later date in March or sometimes in April, I believe it was decided that Commonwealth Day would always be celebrated in Gibraltar at the start of the spring midterm for schools. So that would be 1 day, that would be a bank holiday, and would be the start of the midterm week for schools. And that, what the news simply reflects, is that that is a practice which we expect will happen every year as from 2021.
Can I just ask you that, because I haven't spotted that with my honourable colleague, I've asked questions on it, and it's not a major issue, but that I thought Commonwealth Day is not up to us. But it's actually a day that is celebrated in the Commonwealth, or be it not in the United Kingdom in Oregon. I thought that Commonwealth Day was a fixed date in March, which is set by someone, I'm not sure who, but that is whether it might be Her Majesty, or maybe someone in some kind of council or state somewhere. But it may not be a public holiday, but I wouldn't think that we could just move it around as a domestic
issue. Exactly. The view that we have taken is that the government decides when it chooses to celebrate a particular day of Commonwealth Day in Gibraltar, and for the reasons that I have given the honourable member, which are practical reasons in which I hope the honourable member will understand that it makes sense. We have decided that Commonwealth Day will be celebrated at the start of the next coming winter spring term.
Apart from that, really, do you have a going to be possible spring term? I think, but, however,
whether the end of time looks like it would be full on the kind of usual day, or after the end of the first week of July, what consequences then does it have to take out a week of full days in school? Not at all with the feedback, because the crucial is to set aside people's episode with the number of days that a people's episode would be 188, and that is the number that there ought to be in the school calendar. What we have done is move 2 days which were traditionally school holidays but not bank holidays, the Methodist Assembly and Assembly Thursday. Those days will be normal school days, and instead of having those 2 days off, they are now taken as part of the next week. Added to the Commonwealth Day, that makes 3 days, and then the other 2 days is the reduction of fighting service to freedom service, but the number of hours still having to be laid out in the manner that I suggested for the honourable men. So what we found is a practical solution which does not at all affect the number of days that people are taking to school, but does provide a practical way of achieving a different end in the spring term.
Can I ask, given the answer, was there consultation beyond the Department of Education in the conversion of things like a spring term day, the lack of conception from school holidays?
Consultation has been clearly with the teacher union.
Only with the teacher union, but not on it. It has been in consultation with the church, for example. The speaker, there were discussions on this with representatives of the Catholic Church. This is some time ago, I can't recall the details, but I don't recall any serious objections to it. There were arguments in relation to the fact that children who were going who are going to school is a hazard of concern about attending mass on those particular days, then the school could perhaps arrange for that, and it might even be more likely that they attend school to school, that they stay at home with a difficult parent to work and so on. So I remember the discussion did take place some time ago, but I cannot recall the exact details of this particular thing to specifically ask. I hope that is in some of it.
One minor thing we need to speak about. I know the minister was putting the other magic wand and something like that. There still remains a slight possibility that public examinations in the United Kingdom as at the end of every year, where traditionally they start in May and tend to finish in June, there's a possibility in the UK that those things could be shifted and so on. Is it an understanding with teachers union at the moment that the school calendar may need to have minor adjustments depending on the date when public information will be held and set by the UK Examination Board? Because I don't think that particular issue has been discussed. We've seen reports in the last couple of weeks about the possibility of the examination window for the UK starting later and then obviously finishing later. That may have an effect on the calendar in the same way that the event of this year has had an effect on what has happened in school. I am sure that we will be able to find a practical way forward, but if we will be entirely in terms of exam calendar, we will be entirely in the hands of the examination agency thereafter, in particular by the examination board and the regulator of school in the UK. As with other things that we've spoken about in the past, something that we are actively and continually monitoring, because there are comments and suggestions and reports almost every day about how this is going to pan out, and until a definitive decision is made and an announcement, a formal announcement is made, we won't be able to plan accordingly.
Question number 330 of 2020. provisions concerned, whether the government intends to continue with its commitments to remove the registration fee for the notification of vacancies.
Also, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
Speaker, set out in the Business and Employee Assistance Plan for the waiver of fees that continues throughout the second quarter of 2020. This will be renewed moving forward. With regard specifically to the fees for the registration of vacancies, this was removed as from the 1st of January 2020 for employees with 10 employees or less.
I would like to now focus on the list of the last one we've made, and the removal which was introduced in January. It was introduced in January, was implemented in January, and the reason why I asked this, and I'll move along, but I have a quick look at the relevant legislation, and just to come back to the minister, that the requirement to pay the £70 on the vacancy still arises in the employment agreement. And if you're not aware, I'd ask them to have a look at it and amend the relevant regulations. But the way supplementary response to the motion, Mr. Speaker, is there any intention beyond, once the measures are no longer in place on a permanent basis to look at the other fees which are currently implemented? For example, looking at the relevant page of the government website, and it talks about a fee of £52 for the application for a work permit. And fee of £69 for the notification of central employment of the tax worker, which are pretty cheap. And if the government intends in assisting the economy and improving employment prospects, that perhaps is something that the government will be looking at as a matter of policy going forward.
The issue of the fee scheme as a continuation is something which the Honourable Member will know because it has been announced what is passed in the Senate committee, and arose as from that. And that is the process that will continue going forward in the sector of the review that has been announced. There have been quite a number of incentives and waiver fees and provisions made for businesses. And clearly, there has been, not just in Gibraltar, but more widely, a significant economic impact of the events over the last few months. That is something that the government is very aware of, very alive to, and will be considering. If the Honourable Member is asking whether indefinitely and going forward in a normal situation we will waive all fees, then that is towards a policy decision that might be taken. My understanding is that is not the government's position. If we were today in a normal situation, without having lived in the last 3 months, without having had to implement these, without having had to have a sell-up, we would not have been considering the mass waiver of fees as we have done in the extraordinary circumstances that we've also lived through in the last 3 months.
Mr. Agnew, to answer the point in relation to the legislation, do you think we need a concern on this issue?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I have made a note, and I will look at the legislation. The note I have is that fee is no longer being charged from the 1st of January. Whether that is reflected in the legislation or not, is take what the Honourable Member has said, and we'll check the position, and we will make sure that the legislation reflects the practice.
Question number 231 of 2020. The Honourable is M.D. Hassan Naun.
Is government planning to provide special for children who do not have access to online hardware and facilities so that they can be incorporated into any future online learning programs? Do we need to resort to this practice in the event of a return to lockdown?
Answer. The Honourable the Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, the Department of Education, working with schools, have already issued a number of devices to families. Families who require devices on a loan basis. These families have been identified by head teachers of the respective schools as part of the home learning provision. We continue to work with head teachers in supporting these families in a number of ways. During the pandemic, the department received a donation of 25 iPads from Silicon Valley Bank, which are being used for a special. For the future lockdown take place, the department of education will work with head teachers of all the special schools to implement a similar support structure to any families which are identified as needing support.
Yes, because
as
the minister probably extends lots of books. And I appreciate that many devices have been donated and have enriched these children's home lives as it is at the moment. But my question is more focused in that before we had the first wave of the pandemic, so we say, from what I understand, one of the key reasons why children were not doing home learning was because in order not to discriminate those who didn't have hardware facilities and that there were a lot of them, so that they wouldn't be left behind. So my question is, it's great to hear that some more are being donated and all that, but will that be enough, and is that the plan going forward in order to establish a home learning program, which they haven't been able to do, if we have a second one?
Speaking of most likely have had a home learning program. I have had it given details of this in public and in the South, as we should. In primary schools has been extremely successful, I'm told, and also the provision of home learning for children in secondary education. It is precisely because we've had a home learning program and there has been this engagement with children that there has been identified a need for some children to have some of these devices. I mentioned a donation of 25. In fact, of those 25, 26 have been given out, so we haven't even exhausted the process of that donation. We had, quite apart from that donation, we had already identified the possibility of using iPads, and we had another 40 iPads in stock and available and commissioned in order to be able to issue out. So, if we needed more in the future, then those would certainly be made available. So, we had a substantial number of these devices available, of which 22 have been given out, given the interaction between the schools and the students, which has arisen specifically as a result of the home learning provision, and particularly as a result of the program which schools had in place of being able to identify those children that were engaging with home learning and those that were not, and being able to follow up those that were not, and try and find out the reasons why that was the case. And as a result of that exercise and that continuing training and reaching out to students, a number of students were identified as needing these devices and those were made available.
Thank you, Peter. Once again, I would thank the Minister for his substantial answer. Maybe I need to be the one who's more focused. I appreciate that there was some home learning, and I saw in my own eyes for children across the age and the school system. But in particular, the school system, it wasn't curriculum-based. It was more sort of like to stimulate the children, and there was no sort of curriculum-focused learning session. So I think maybe I'll have to ask the minister once again. But my question to them has been to whether all this hardware will come to something and come to establishing a curriculum-based learning system if we have a second wave and not sort of filler. And I say filler with all due respect because I understand that, you know, things will have hazards and it just didn't get good at the time, but it was a filler essentially in the sense that it wasn't a curriculum-based program. So I'm asking whether the government intends to establish a curriculum-based program if we have a second wave and if they will have enough hardware resources to provide children who may not have it at home in order to continue with our curriculum-based program.
Because there is no question that sufficient resources would be available. This is not a filler, whether in the loose sense or not. It was a decision that was taken by the Department of Education to focus on learning in this particular way. I believe that I have answered questions in this House in relation to the curriculum and the fact that the curriculum was paused. So the issue of not following the curriculum wasn't in order to not discriminate children that might not have these devices, because we have devices available, but for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the curriculum was paused in the UK, and the fact that it is impossible, as I have explained previously in the South, it is impossible to replicate the classroom environment through a home learning scheme, and
and there will be some children that are better suited to home learning than others. There are some children that are better independent learners than others, clearly because you don't have that interaction with a teacher as you would in the classroom and the department for the consultation with the teachers and the school. So that the focus would be the home learning provision that we have provided and specifically designed for this purpose. What is clear is that having put all of this together in a very short space of time, literally in a matter of a day or a week or 10 days, when the older children got down, started and there was a real need for this provision to be made, it is clear that we have now learned from the issues that arise from that, the kind of interaction that has been with these children, improvements that can be made, and if there is a need to reinstate this kind of provision in the future, we will be in a much better position than certainly we were in months.
I think to hear the experience of the younger lady and the opportunity so far as online is also been concerned, because the question of course we really answered at the last session when posed by my Minister Mr. Rayles in relation to this point. But I think the younger lady makes a good point as to the nature of the delivery of the curriculum. Now, the Minister talks about the impossibility at that point in time of delivering the national curriculum to our students. But there have been many concerns expressed, and I'm sure to the Honourable Lady as well in relation to this point, as to how much further we can go in a lockdown situation of delivering this type of education, the basic curriculum in terms of English and Maths to our students. Now, really, it's a fine example of what we, in my family, did as far as my son is concerned. We delivered sort of two-stage past papers in order to get him going in English and Maths during the lockdown period. And so not all parents have the facilities of printing facilities and hardware facilities as the lady has described. But Mr. Speaker, if the pandemic is going to be with us for some time, and circumstances are such that there is, as described, another wave of the disease, the government must have plans in place to cater for the delivery of curriculum over a longer period of time to our students. Because the world, although stopped learning for a few months, we do need to have in place, I wouldn't agree with this, provisions in place for the delivery of curriculum in the way that's been described in this class. And I'd be eager to learn more about what the Minister's plans are in relation to that.
I think I have a certain possibility of delivering the curriculum. I have the possibility of replicating a classroom environment and the difficulty that that creates for particular children. And therefore, by delivering, I think, simply able to deliver the curriculum, then we would have had children being left behind. That is what we wanted to avoid. So it was a deliberate policy decision for us to prevent certain children being left behind, that there was an activity-based program both for the primary sector and a different kind of program for the secondary sector, in order to stimulate the children, provide them with enough resources, the medical abilities that are required, in order to be able to continue with the curriculum and resume normal education in the future. And so what might happen in the future? Well, I remember we spoke to earlier, we were having a crystal ball, and none of us do, and none of us know what's around the corner with this particular issue. So that doesn't mean that we don't have plans. We do have plans as to what we intend to do in September. There is a question in the order paper as to that, which I propose to answer in the moment.
Next question.
Question number 232 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Naun.
Will the Education Minister confirm if all school years will recommence their full educational programme, class-based or online, in September, and can we offer a guarantee for a seamless transition in the case of a return to a full or partial lockdown to online teacher-led curriculum-based learning?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port. Speaker, I will answer this question together with Section 333 and 334.
Question number 233 of 2020.
end is only only a bond now.
So is government considering extending the school day in the future, for example, by providing more than one school shift? Should there still be a need to adhere to social distancing requirements come September in order to secure minimal disruption to students' learning time?
234 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M.D. of Dunham.
Is government looking to incorporate any added locations to separate students whilst continuing with curriculum-based learning in the event of a resurgence of COVID-19 within our community?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port. Mr. Speaker, it is the government's intention to open all schools for all children in September. This will be done in full compliance with advice from the Director of Public Health and in consultation with participants at the NAS and WC. Lately, the circumstances relating to COVID-19 that we find ourselves in near the time will have to be taken into account. However, given the low numbers of coronavirus infections which we have had in our community, and based on current figures, there can be no justification in keeping children at home. Our intention is therefore to operate schools normally in September, but in what will still be an abnormal scenario. As we have done for the phase and gradual reopening of schools as part of the unlock the lock process, the Department of Education will issue guidance on measures which will need to be applied in all schools. This is expected to include staggered entry and exit for different year groups, staggered breaks to the extent possible, and where the curriculum allows keeping the same classes together throughout the day, special arrangements for lunchtime to avoid large gatherings, limiting access to schools to children and staff except by appointment, using thermal scanners, and using one-way circulation routes where possible. Face masks and face shields will be made available to all staff who wish to use them. We do not envisage the need to extend the school day. The process generally, including with regard to education, is now better prepared to deal with any resurgence of COVID-19 in our community than we were in March. We were able to react quickly and put measures in place to protect our community. We went from normality to lockdown in a very short space of time. We have then experienced a gradual easing of restrictions in six different spaces, the last of which is expected to end on the 1st of August. Given our experience since March, we are naturally now in a better position to deal with any resurgence of COVID-19. It is impossible at this stage to know what any such resurgence will look like, should it ever happen. A resurgence does not necessarily mean a return to lockdown. It could mean reverting to a previous phase, as we have seen in other countries. The manner in which we continue to provide education for our children naturally depends on the type of any restrictions that might be imposed in the event of a resurgence or second wave. I am confident that our experience so far and the lessons we have learned from this will allow us to continue to provide meaningful and curriculum-based learning for our children.
Mr. Speaker, thank you to the Honourable Minister for that answer. I'd like to ask him if class teachers have an identity and have a project and had the opportunity to be a part of this planning ahead for the new academic year, and whether the plan takes into account contingencies that may have to be applied for possible further closures in terms of how the teachers have been engaged in this process.
The Department of Education generally has a policy of discussing plans, especially with teachers. So, this will have happened. It's not something that I myself have been involved in, but I have been involved in the formulation of the policies and plans which I have outlined in my answer.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Speaker. Can I ask if teaching staff are receiving all the necessary training to ensure that their delivery of online lessons and use of technology may be optimized if this actually happens?
Speaker, I'm not sure what the Honourable Member means by training. If the Honourable Member means that where there have been formal sessions
during the period of lockdown, then the lockdown clearly has provided a number of restrictions as to what could be done. But certainly, the information I have is that the Department of Education has engaged fully with the schools and clearly with the staff in order to maximize the use of the home learning system and schemes which have been put in place both at primary level and secondary level.
Question number 335 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Naum.
Is the government currently monitoring health and safety practices in terms of prevention of infection with COVID-19 and the quality of provision in private nurseries and preschools?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
On Monday, 2nd of March 2020, the Director of Public Health has left all private nurseries at a meeting where the battery offered advice on social distancing and how to manage a clean environment for representatives of every private nursery in Gibraltar. The Gibraltar government trusts the private nursery staff and will follow the advice and guidance given to them as well as to other private businesses. And I would add to that answer, Mr. Speaker, that at some point in March, we went into lockdown and the vast majority of the nurseries actually closed. I believe that all by one actually closed and they resumed either on or around the time that we opened our schools, or just before that, which would have been to the late May.
Mr. Speaker, in terms of private nurseries, the government issued licenses and permits, from what I understand, for them to be able to provide childcare services. Once those permits are issued and the nurseries are open, are there follow-up inspections in place to ensure that the standards continue to be met?
This is an issue that the Honourable Member raised in writing with me, and she has been given a response as to what the Department of Education does. Essentially, as you said, the Department of Education monitors the registration of private nurseries and the registration process involves the assessment of the quality of provision of that nursery. The nursery needs to be registered in Hopkins House and be in possession of a business license. They need to have a certificate of fitness from the GPC Environmental Agency and the Gibraltar Fire Service. They are required to provide a business plan with their employees, their qualifications, and enhanced DBS check for anyone working on these premises. The premises are accepted by the Department of Education to ensure that there is ample space for children, that the type of education and equipment is appropriate for the age range, and that the necessary health and safety steps have been taken. An example of things to look out for is the toileting facilities and whether they are appropriate for the number of children attending, or whether the area that is used for children is kept safe from other areas of the nursery, like the kids' kitchen. The cleaning cupboard will be administered often. When the Department of Education is satisfied with the nursery needs, these requirements, a certificate is issued to inform the nursery and the user that the business and the premises are officially registered with the Department of Education. Subsequent to that, there is ongoing and ad hoc discussion and engagement between the Department of Education and nursery. I am aware of one, for example, happened today, where the Department of Education becomes involved in issues that arise or in advice. Specifically, during the last 3 months, we had inquiries from the nursery as to the opening of it or their intentions to open the nursery and seeking guidance from the Department of Education. And the Department of Education was able to provide the guidance as appropriate in keeping with public health guidelines.
Can I just ask one last the Minister says that there are ad hoc engagements and discussions, and that's fantastic. But in terms of inspections, can I ask whether how frequently these inspections are and who actually carries them out?
The feedback. I believe that there is actually a formal process of flood inspections in the same way that we don't have the formal process of flood inspections of what's called individuals as they have in the UK. That is my understanding of the position that has generally been in the case. It's not a new policy that has been introduced by the government.
Question number 336 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. Kennedy Hassan-Mallon.
From the start of the COVID crisis to the present day, how many referrals were made to early intervention counsellors? For A, how many children have been referred to mental health services? B, how many children have been referred to child protection services? And C, how many children have been referred to educational psychologists?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
Before I answer that question, I just clarify something that I said a moment ago about inspections of schools and the process of inspections of schools. I actually meant third party inspections by outsiders from schools. There are literally inspections and contacts on a daily basis between the Department of Education and all the schools in Gibraltar. In answer to question 336, since 24th of March 2020, when the majority of government schools were closed, there have been 6 new referrals of children to the school counseling service, 7 new referrals to mental health services, 2 new referrals to child protection services, and 6 new referrals to educational psychology.
Can I ask if the referrals, are they currently live and ongoing cases, or exactly how many have been resolved, if any?
The question that was asked was purely statistical. I don't have the answer to the Honourable Member. In any event, sometimes when there are onward referrals to other professionals, then it's important for those professionals to take part and deal with the case going forward. Unfortunately, I'm not able to give the Honourable Member the answer that he's thinking about whether any of these cases are still live or not.
I appreciate that answer, Mr. Speaker. Can I ask whether the Minister is able to tell us whether the number of cases of the ones I asked were a higher rate considering the period in time or the restrictions that may have led to, and whether maybe he can give us some information on the lessons that may have been drawn from the situation, whether there be a report for public scrutiny on what findings have come out of the staff in this sort of special period in time.
I don't have other figures to be able to compare with these particular figures, but these are very specific figures, and it's not as if we are able to say during the last lockdown last year, the year before, we had these referrals, and during this lockdown, we have had these referrals. Simply from my own observation, these numbers do not appear to be too high or alarming. There is a system of referrals to school counseling service that has been ongoing, and I believe that on a previous occasion in which I have given figures in relation to the referrals to school counselors in the past, although that I would need to check.
Question number 237 of 2020. The end is Andy Hassan-Mallon.
Will there be a publicly available report of the work achieved by the Reach Out and Safe to Talk initiative, and if so, when will it be available?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, I am happy to report to this House on the work done by the Reach Out and Safe to Talk initiative. Both the Reach Out and Safe to Talk initiative and continue to have the common aim of providing children and their families with an avenue of support during COVID. Both initiatives were launched at the end of March and are still running. The aim of the Reach Out initiative was to put teachers directly in contact with their students to reach out cause have been made to families across all sectors. These have been in addition to the thousands of interactions and online messages by people, Google Classroom, Edmodo, emails and text messages, in which school staff have communicated with parents and young people in our community. At the start of the pandemic, working parties of teachers and pastoral leads identified risks and issues around our socially and emotionally vulnerable students. Using a common protocol, teachers have kept in contact with the more at-risk families and those children not accessing support through the channels available. Teachers identify families who needed additional support, who needed a different home learning services, or who required information on helplines and on support available. Sometimes families were directed to the support, and on other occasions, where needed, teachers or the advisory team would make contact on their behalf. Most often, teachers have provided a listening ear to parents and have provided advice on children's emotional well-being, on difficulties children are facing with disruption to their routine, or on any challenges the child or family were encountering with the home learning program. The two most frequent avenues of support were to reach out to direct families and young people to, for the home learning team and the care agency, child protection team. However, families and young people have also been directed to other avenues of support. These have included the 111 helpline, the 41818 helpline, the care agency early intervention team, the mental health team, including contact with engaging nurses, the civil continuous evacuation team and borders and coast guard, the school counselors, and the educational psychologists. The Reach Out Initiative also recognized that during this period of increased anxiety, children who were not originally identified as being at risk might also find themselves in need of support. Teachers have been vigilant to those not engaging in the home learning platform and have followed up where deemed appropriate in order to ascertain whether or not a young person or family has experienced any difficulties that they could be supported with. Any child or parent who has expressed worries and concerns through the learning platform or through initiatives such as the Safe Talk have also been followed up on. The aim has been to try and remain maintain a level of engagement, connection and communication with families and young people who mainly rely on schools and on the familiar individuals within schools for support. In step one of the education roadmap was implemented on the 26th of May, when the childcare facilities were offered in all school spaces and the 2, 6 and 7 were brought back to school. The Department of Education itself has stepped up to support mechanisms further. Throughout the pandemic, the Department of Education has worked with its staff and other agencies to monitor the children in our community and identify those who are more at risk, either by staff at the start of the pandemic, by the telephone strategy, or through disclosures made to police, schools, or care agencies. As these children became known, schools reached out to families and arrangements were made with the Department of Education for them to come back to school as one of the categories for whom child care facilities were available. 130 vulnerable children have returned to school as a result of the communications exchange via the Reach Out program. Additionally, the Reach Out initiative has recognized the need to support teachers. In particular, the emotional impact that can result from working with vulnerable children has been recognized, especially during uncertain and anxiety-ridden times. Self-care was advocated within the Reach Out strategy. After the agent, with the COVID-19 welfare team, a strategy for teachers was formulated to work in unison with a group frontline resilience management initiative, or FRM initiative. The strategy aims to both support teachers' own mental well-being during this very emotionally challenging time, and to also help teachers support children's emotional well-being. The strategy consisted of three elements: staff resilience management, self-care, and active listening. 242 teachers and learning support assistants attended the training session. Staff feedback on the back of these sessions was overwhelming. Individuals reported the sessions had been extremely useful and supportive. The Close to Talk initiative has acted as both a signposting service and a forum for which the young community, as well as their parents and guardians, have been able to reach out for emotional support. The initiative comes under the school council. The helpline was set up on the 16th of March 2020, with social media platforms, Facebook and Instagram coming into operation on the 24th of March. a variety of total channels of communication allows the students to communicate with the counselors in whichever way they prefer and were more comfortable with. The How Can I Help form gave an additional pathway to access help. Information about the strategy was disseminated among staff and students through the Department of Education's website, via social media, flyers, and also through the school's own educational platform. Place to Talk was also offered a space for teachers to use as part of the wider welfare service. This could be to communicate any concerns directly related to any work being undertaken in the educational facility during lockdown or to address their own COVID-related anxieties. Teachers were invited to reach out for either a well-being check-in with further sessions organized as and when appropriate, or some reflective practice sessions. During the lockdown period, the Place to Talk team has actively reached out to the children and young people who were supporting them, who they were supporting before lockdown, who have been finding life difficult, not necessarily directly because of the pandemic, but because they need the lines of support. School teachers, LFA, the KIM team at the PHA, were not available to them due to the lockdown. Teaching staff have been able to raise concerns about children and young people with school counselors, and where appropriate, the team has forced links with these students and their families. If necessary, the team has then made any relevant inquiries to other agencies. Parents have asked the Place to Talk not just to ask for support for their children due to mental distress, but also to ask for support for themselves when struggling with emotional impact for supporting their children at home, of course. And services have been appealed around the expectations of home learning, about the plans to return to school, about the education facility, and the safety of children and young people in school.
It was because really thank from the bottom of my heart, one of the ministers who is carrying on, and it goes about that I appreciate it, honestly. And I apologize in advance on my supplementary. You may have already touched on it, and I may have like missed it because, you know, it was done, and I just want to make sure. But my supplementary really was, I wanted to know, despite all the wonderful things that you said that they have put in place, which I accept, whether they have on case support, if there's been any support in healthcare services like speech therapy and other services that users have been needing and have been forced throughout COVID, has government launched a plan or an incentive for these services to now resume and catch up and deal with the backlog of the holding of those services during COVID, please?
Unfortunately, these are some of the services that have been affected by the COVID issues, but these are GBK services rather than educational services. Certainly, I have been in touch with the GHA, specifically with the director or the medical director, Dr. Chris Lowell, specifically on these kind of services. I was particularly concerned that we need to resume these kind of services to particularly vulnerable children, for example, children at St. Martin's, who rely on this service. And we have been working from a Department of Education perspective with the GHA and specifically with the medical director in order to be able to agree the resumption of these services. My understanding is that the services have resumed, although they are not totally back to what they were before the lockdown happened, and it is something that the Department of Education continues to work with the GHA on. I note from the Honourable Member's question and genuine concern that these services do provide something of value for the children, and I genuinely agree with that concern and would hope that working together with the GHA, we will be able to resume as much normality as possible, given the present time, to the resumption of these services to children who really need them.
Question number 238 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Lam.
The Department of Education has stated that information has been made available to students in order to support them in understanding the process of grading and appeals, and yet this is still a common question being posed by constituents. Can the Minister please confirm that all GCSEs and A-level students who are expecting their grades this year have received appropriate information
communication has ensured that all publicly available information on the awarding of grades and the subsequent technical process is available on the website www.education.gov.br. The three institutions working with GCSE and A-level students have also disseminated to their students via their own online platform a letter published by Oxford. The details regarding grading and appeals are provided for by Oxford and subsequently published on, again, the education.gov.br platform with any, when any new information is needed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Since the teachers, I believe that the teachers have already submitted their test grades to the examining board, they will already, they're likely to know which students are going to receive what grades and which ones will need to read their exams in November. So is any support being put now to ensure students are able to follow up their skills for November?
They want to take an exam,
Concord was then yet quite a few. There was a Wikipedia with certain subjects, core subjects and additional subjects, and that is expected to continue this year as it has in every other single year.
Question number 239 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan-Naum.
Has government included the reimbursement of semester-related flights to students as one of the qualifying expenses within its COVID-19 grant reimbursement criteria?
Answer, the Honourable Minister of Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
If part of the devoted policy award, students are given a flight allowance which is separate to their maintenance grant. This allowance is intended to cover the cost of one return flight a year. The current annual allowance is £1,041. There will be no reimbursement required of any part of this allowance. The exercise being conducted by the Department of Education relates only to the maintenance grant for the third term, which the flight allowance is not part of.
Peter, I fully appreciate the Minister's answer because it's obviously an issue of policy and that's what it is. But I think it's some confusion because I've had representations from more than one concerned parent saying that basically the children had to take extra flights, the flights that went through time because of COVID to come home, and that has impacted their budget because in the amount that the government is willing to reimburse, whether it be for apartments or rentals that they were in contract with, flights were expensive and needed to be paid for and taken to come home. So as a sensible life, I'm sorry to be repetitive, but just to ascertain from the minister, in these circumstances, these flights that were, if you like, force majeure on the student would not be reimbursed as part of the grant balance sheet. So we say for the students it has to come out of their own pocket.
I've understood the question relating to the investment. I think the question. The honourable member was asking about the investment by the students to government, rather than the government to students. So, if the honourable member is asking about the investment of flight to students, there is no question of the investment. There is a flight allowance which is given, which is supposedly for one return flight, which is 1,041. And if I may venture to suggest on my side, it is a very general allowance. Traditionally, the grant, the policy includes maintenance for term 1, maintenance for term 2, maintenance for term 3. There are some additional costs which are covered, like return welfare to the university that you are attending, and one return flight a year. That is what I understand we've all been privy to. But the current allowance for one return flight a year is 1,041. What I would like to convey, and I hope I did convey in my answer, is that the government is not in the reimbursement from the students of any part of the 1,041 pounds. However, it may have been spent or not spent, because that is not part of the exercise concerning the maintenance grant. The question the honourable member asked is, students have had additional expenses this last term because of the special situation we are in, which have involved flight. To the extent that the students have been required to meet from the maintenance grant for the third term, expenses in the third term which are related to that course of study, then that is something that they would normally pay from the maintenance grant. And that part will not be required to be reimbursed from the student to the government. It is quite naturally an expense which comes out of the maintenance grant, which is normally paid, but this is separate from the specific grant allowance, which is paid on a one-off basis to the student, and for which the government will not seek any kind of reimbursement.
Okay, so to get this right, when a student goes away, he gets a maintenance fund, and apart from that, a 1,041 allowance. So, over the no COVID, the flight would have been accounted for from that 1,041, and if parents and or the students had any issues, it would have had to come out of that 1,041, and it won't be accounted for in any other part of the budget. Okay, thank you.
The Honourable Member for the Cabinet of what I said is correct.
And I need to think of this first, I think I'm just going to be making this to keep the White House to go to bring it. The Honourable Lady's question, which thankfully has now been carried away, but it refers to semester-related flights. Semester-related flights means more European systems, means in 6 months, that two terms in a very year, you will find those studying in places like Italy, where I'm one of those other countries that's coming there. At the end of the year, September, October. The first semester ends in January, the termination period is in February, and then you start the second semester, which ends in June and July. For those attending Newcomb University, you can refer to us two semesters because there are three terms in the next year. We just have to clarify when it is a reference you may have in the second question. Thank you for your patience.
Question number 340 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. MD stands now.
Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm that all children who have been offered university places starting in September 2020 and who achieve the necessary grades will receive the scholarship grant as would have been expected had the COVID-19 crisis not taken place?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Employment, Utilities and the Port.
The request for the award of Members for Eligible Development Scholarship for the 2020-2021 academic year will remain the same as in previous years. Students who meet the eligibility criteria and have successfully completed their A-level program of study this academic year will be able to apply for scholarship award from the Department of Education in the same way as they would in other years.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Speaker, there are numerous students expecting to commence university in September 2020, and because of the situation and the grades and all that, they may decide to hurry up. And I just get a confirmation from the minister that if these students defer by a year, nothing will change in terms of their status in order to acquire this grant equally.
Speaker, any student entitled to a mandatory award that seeks to defer the entry to university until next year because of any uncertainty that may happen this particular year will not be affected at all and will still be entitled next year to the mandatory award.
Question number 394 of 2020. Beyond R.M. Clinton. Mr. Speaker, is the government contemplating the closure of its office in Hong Kong? Answer, the Honourable, the Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Mr. Speaker, the city of Hong Kong office, which is situated in One Exchange Square, Central Hong Kong, was not renewed when it terminated in October of 2018. We therefore continued our representation in Hong Kong, but not in that office, and we did not renew this delivery by this month.
I'm grateful to the Minister for his answer. Just to confirm what I just heard, the lease was not renewed in 2018. Is the Minister then advise how or what, in what way are the functions that were carried out in that office being carried out now? And are there any paid personnel in Hong Kong fulfilling that function?
Mr. Speaker, they are working in the same way as the rest of the world has been working for the past 4 months, using modern technology. Do we still have anybody
employed yet, the local representative is still active in working with it.
I'm speaking of course, maybe this will still be a couple of months ago, but the news of the office is not being renewed. And at this time, was there any reduction in personnel on the payroll?
We've had different people supporting the Hong Kong representative throughout his appointment. So the wording, specifically when on what dates, I would have to get back to Hong Kong and be able to do it later.
I think this is the problem for what one file to supplementary of it. Well, how many staff in terms of individual people are actually currently employed in Hong Kong, whether physically or not from an office, or obviously we don't have an office, are engaged by the government, including functions of the office in Hong Kong. How many people do you normally see currently have there now?
Mr. Speaker, one.
I think the original answer was that the government has not really used the lease because it did not think at that moment making a judgment that there was value for money in the general store. There's no real value for money in the team of the office, but it must continue to view, to have the view, that there is a purpose in having representation and personality in Hong Kong. And if so, what is the, has the role of the representative change in the function and scope of the activity being conducted and what kind of minister comment on future activity?
Mr. Speaker, the role continues today as it was. We are considering and have some thoughts as to what the future will hold, not just in Hong Kong, but in other jurisdictions as well, in terms of how we can best be represented in a number of countries where we are targeting for financial services, community, and other areas. So the future is under review at the moment, and we're continuing to do the things that we're doing.
Hong Kong, and as I mentioned,
known as affluent. So now affluent members of Hong Kong society, who given the current climate in Hong Kong and the actions of the Chinese government in relation to the position of Hong Kong, this is something that we as a community or the government are actively considering supporting insofar as that position. I appreciate in the context of this question, of course, that it verges on the responsibilities of public outside of this path, and therefore the answer to that question may be misinterpreted by that position. But would the government support the proposition and indeed the offer made by the British Prime Minister to the people of Hong Kong, who are within the eligibility to relocate the United Kingdom? Would you be better and even go further and support the statements by the Foreign Secretary, Donald Rudd, that China must stand by its obligations under the arrangements entered into in relation to Hong Kong, so that the people of Hong Kong should have the benefit of the protection that was set out in that agreement, being the perspective, and that indeed, when the position was set out by the national government in respect of the ability of persons in Hong Kong to reside in the United Kingdom and indeed to acquire further rights as to British nationality beyond their DNA status, which would also be fully supportive of that and would welcome people from Hong Kong to come to Gibraltar to fulfill the eligibility requirements for residents in Gibraltar. And indeed, not just the affluent and wealthy. I mean, there are many good, talented, entrepreneurial people in Hong Kong who will be looking for another fantastic place in which to establish their businesses, in which to develop their entrepreneurial skills, in which to share their skills and educate those who they bring their skills to also. And the government will be fully supportive of that, and we take the view to get that. The position set out by the United Kingdom government is the right one, and it is British agency territory is potentially one of the places where some of the people of Hong Kong may find and build their homes in the future. We would be very welcoming of that and of the skills that they will bring. To respond to the question, I'm grateful for the Chief Minister's confirmation that I entirely agree insofar as the scope of individual concern that would merit reflection in this jurisdiction, Mr. Speaker. But the final proposal, of course, as you mentioned, and I said quite clearly, when you consider the actions taken by China, the People's Republic, to be in breach of the Sino-British agreement and indeed the basic law of Hong Kong. Does the Chief Minister echo those sentiments and those statements made by the British Prime Minister so far as the breach of those instruments went across? Mr. Gibraltar does not have at his disposal the information that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has in making that assessment. The Chief of Gibraltar, nonetheless, is an interest in international affairs, as do all members of this House, no doubt. And from my reading in the international press, which may or may not be the full picture, I would share the position of the Prime Minister, which illustrates why it is absolutely right that the agreements done by the Foreign Office in 1984, which included an agreement in relation to Gibraltar, which set up on a track which was not similar to the track on which the United Kingdom set Hong Kong for eventual handover, were agreements to be deprecated, feared, and ultimately assumed, as they were, by convention of this House and the people of Gibraltar. May I just ask on the welcome statement that the Chief Minister made in relation to the attitude and approach that the government has taken to the people of Hong Kong, were they to wish to express an interest in coming to the Gibraltar on a variety of challenges or indeed for economic migration reasons. Beyond the approach, would it then be the government's intended policy, or would it, after the session, perhaps consider that it is appropriate to do the Hong Kong effort to pursue a policy of encouragement of economic migration to the region? The Honourable Gentleman asked me whether that would be the case on the question in the future time. That has already been the case. We have already embarked on that process, and I'm not in a position yet to make any statements in that respect, other than to say that we have reached out so that people understand that the things that we're here and have resolved to delay in the future. And those are the people of Hong Kong who can no longer consider the same as a viable proposition.
apologise, and I'll make this very short. I know that the Honourable Minister and I have an exchange as to Gibraltar's international offices, and we know as well about it that I've supported the government so far. It's international offices and what it's trying to achieve in terms of economic activity, and obviously the opposition has drilled down and copped that on a number of occasions. But I do recall that the Honourable Minister was looking towards other territories such as India, and I wonder whether anything has come from that initial observation that we made in the last Parliament as to whether we are actively engaging with the Indian continent in so far as the continent in so far as any work deriving from there. Because there was the time I believe a project that was embarked on, I think it was 2025, I was called clearly and then opted in so far as opening an office in India.
Because I think you're earlier, we are reviewing considering the form of representation that the financial institutions require in the moment of the future of the and I think once we finish this process, we trust those future in terms of our plans, I think that's much better position to explain in more detail what we are thinking and how we're going to be doing it. So I think certainly we'll be able to make some good progress in respect of our vision.
Question number 395 of 2020. The Honourable R. M. Clinton.
Speaker. Can we then survive one war which are absolutely global and allow the two by step to the government of nearly £2 million in respectable fear wage and over £400,000 in personal insurance for the period 2018-19 and 2019-20?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, we are currently engaging discussions on the recovery of the money, and it would not be appropriate or helpful to send it to the nation this moment in time across the floor of the House. I would be happy to brief the Honourable Member on a private basis and answer the question fully at a later session where this would not prejudice our efforts to recover the money.
I'm grateful to the Minister for his patience, and I will be happy to take up the offer. I would just ask the Minister to take note that I have representation from traders and Main Street to get calls from Central Arrears Unit actually being lost with, making sure that their payments are up to date, and that it has been great to do with small traders who have been taking the payments when they're not even in arrears. And yes, we're here for this particular case. I would just ask the Minister's statement that I will probably take up his suggestion of a prior briefing.
Question number two.
I don't I take note of what the member has referred me to with the small trade is being tipped quite rightly in respect of arrears. I think the Indian was first shift in respect of the degrees, and the reason for why I'm not wishing to make any comment further than that is simply because we fully expect to recover every single penny of the degrees in the fullness of time. So I don't want to prejudice that, but my suggestion is that the main cost for them. Let nobody think for a moment that the milestones are left unneeded in respect of any of the things that the government is trying to do in general. Mr. Hobbiton, we strongly advise people to be up to date. Those who have been receiving end of paying these applications because they weren't up to date, we have evidence of that. So, of course, the ability to stay up to date, even in difficult times, is clear and obvious to all of you, small and indeed larger businesses, too, as the consequences of not being doing are serious and significant.
Question number 396 of 2020. The Honourable E.J. Bosnian.
Cabinet Secretary for Financial Services said the rent is expected that the private sector banking act will be passed.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
The current rent is information according to the timetable set out in the act.
Thank you.
the honourable member minister referring to, I think section 4.2 or something. Is that what we mean by the time table set out in the Act?
I have got that conception, but it's a bit more to do with what type of employers who actually come into effect for at that time. I fully take the point in terms of the commencement and the implementation. It's not to find a little bit more of a confusion that I can do that in this way as a little period. So, in respect of each of the sections of employers that the Act provides for, it will be implemented fully at the dates that are in the Act, and we're making a certainly in September, in preparation for next summer, when the first batch of employees will be impacted on by the state
treatment. I'm also concerned that the Act itself is not yet finished, it's not yet in force.
No.
Is there any intention on the part of the government to delay the implementation date for the hazard to the recommendations from various interested sectors? I don't know if anyone's looking at making representations to the government, even if it's even himself, even if it's even being out to the House. So, the government is considering by way of policy amendments of the implementation date as a result of the extra expenses that we've got on the extra expense that we're burdening the results of the business.
Mr. Minister, the dates are set out in the Act that we intend them to be. Everyone at some time knows fully what the repercussions are for all of the employers of providing pensions for their staff in the manner that the Act sets out. And I have not had formal representations made to me that have been mentioned to me by one of our senior executives, who's met with Capcom, the Pension Monitoring Association. But their interest is more in ensuring that people were ready, and hence I'm just referring to a statement we made in September, setting out fully the details in terms of the pension's commissioner, how to operate, so the technical duties of how to work, rather than any information of delaying the implementation date. We believe this is good for employees and supporting them for the firms and providing pensions for everybody in our company.
Question number 397 of 2020. The Honourable DJ Bocino. And then in the case for language, in our financial services, says how long he expects that virtual meeting that he will continue for.
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government has yet not in a position to confirm how long the DBC will continue with virtual meetings. And to be further noted, will continue to be held virtually and streaming live.
So that, when the break of the minister's reply, when the fact that this is happening was announced in our government press release, was issued, it said that that was the first phase of the project. So the second phase will allow the general public and the media to view the entire meeting to its live stream as it is happening. Has that occurred? And if not, whether you expect that second phase will be given?
Mr. Speaker, there has been one meeting that has been held in this manner. The reason we did not live stream that meeting is to ensure that the technology we are using works efficiently for all the members of the Planning Commission. So the person has had our budgeted. And there were no technical issues that prevent us from live streaming the next meeting, which I understand is going to be on the 17th of July. And therefore, as I've been saying, it's live due to the meeting, will be live streamed, and the public will be able to watch the proceedings as we had indicated we wanted to.
Question number 398 of 2020. The Honourable Mr. Bocino.
Can the Minister provide a further state whether it is expected to continue with online services currently in force across the various government departments?
Answer, the Honourable for Digital and Financial Services.
These are all questions together with question 399.
Question number 399 of 2020. The Honourable
Government taking any steps to assist the elderly when needing to make non-electronic payments of government counties?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. Mr. Speaker, the government has to adapt very quickly to maintain the public sector working and delivering urgent online processes during the COVID-19 pandemic. I feel that we have provided for every single government user to have web browser access and 700 VPN accounts set up, almost 100 laptops issued, Microsoft Teams, Zoom, and BlueJeans installed and necessary to enable virtual meetings across the government service and to ensure that all our public servants are able to work remotely. Cabinet meetings, TPC meetings are examples of the benefits of using technology during this period. My thanks to the team at ITLD for enabling technology to support our work at this difficult and challenging time. The government has taken steps to ensure that any payment made at a government counter can be done online, and of course, we will provide a facility for those who do not work online, including any of our senior citizens. It is the intention of the government to continue to roll out online services, and we are actively working to deliver these.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Honourable Member for his answer. I ask personally because I have reports by elderly constituents that they're finding it almost impossible to pay their bills and administrate their bills and their issues because everything is online and apparently what they call me cash payments are not accepted due to COVID measures. And it's putting them a lot of anxiety because a lot of them don't have a clue how to access technology and they're limited in this way. So will governments be taking this into account and make cash payments a normal measure in the future? And if so, when? Because Mr. Speaker, I tell you the minister, you know, from the bottom of my heart, it really is causing a lot of members of our community, the elderly members, a lot of anxiety. And it's still like the problem is they're going to be cut off, they're going to have to pay, and they really have no idea.
Of course, we understand and acknowledge that, and steps, as I said in my answer, have been taken to provide such a facility where anybody who is aware from my including, of course, from our senior citizens, because many of them are very proficient in using online services. But those that aren't, there will be a facility in the center of town that we should be able to come and pay for any of their services with government. What we're not going to do is ask somebody who is working with employment, to go to employment to pay, or indeed to pay any part of any government service where that service is delivered from. So it would be a central point, one for the whole of government, in the central town where we would be inviting hopefully next week people to come and make any cash payments and reach any at that one facility. Thank you.
I'm just going to look on the other side of the equation. Continuing to provide this online service into the future, even beyond sort of once we get through the pandemic, is there anyone in crisis is in there, whether the government be minded to provide this service going forward? And there are many people that, for example, they need to be for finding a business, and that type of thing, and we find it very, very useful thing to do so by way of email as well to have in touch with them physically and find things. One example, but there are other government departments where this service has been improved, and whether the government will continue to provide this radical service in the future.
Mr. Speaker, that's precisely what we are working towards, and if I can just explain, we will be rolling out the two services that we will be proposing at some time, and probably the first one very, very shortly, which will have the full service that we work at some time. As a result of COVID, we're going to accelerate the process of digitization across all the government services. And what we're doing there is, in the immediate term, providing what we call improved key services by email that we have developed and we'll be launching very, very next week. The new forms for two of the government departments that we've worked on the last week. That work continues in parallel to the full services project. So the intention is that we will have a complete set of different services either in the most automated manner for some departments and improved levels for others, but we will all have a form of digital services being provided to the people of
our community. So the office went and we continue to roll those out week by week as from next week as we go on.
Stephen, let me ask the Minister why there is that distinction between departments and people. You talk about the more fluid version and then we have the more sophisticated version. And I'm paraphrasing the case. But why that distinction between departments is represented as I understand that.
Because the crude version is the one we've done very quickly and very slow motion. The nicer automated version is the full story that we've been rolling out across the entirety of government as and when we get to all the departments. So we had some time ago to the forefront of employment, which is relevant. We initially opted out with the tax and then a big chunk of the GOJ, and then we would go through to all the other departments and rolling out the different services. Now, for those that aren't ready, we want to call the crew friends. So this is an interesting level.
Thank you, Chief. If I may just ask one question. I accept and appreciate the Honourable Minister's revelation that next week will have like a central space for people to go and settle their bills, and probably as we spoke, it will probably be concentrated with more elderly people who don't do things online. So in light of the current crisis and the situation, can government give us a commitment that perhaps there'll be added measures and protocols in these centres, given that more elderly people will visit and they are more at risk to COVID, like perhaps masks and other things deployed where maybe in other places there wouldn't be some of the concentration of the elderly probably in these centres?
Close challenges because we didn't want them face to face, especially for our senior citizens. On the one hand, we're already pressing for quite rightly, students who can't go online to be able to pay, and especially whatever government invoices they have outstanding, and at the same time, say to us, we've got to take precautions. Of course, we take precautions in light of where we are today. But it is difficult because we're going to be keeping clean up. To settle their campaigns if they happen to be senior citizens. But unfortunately, if you want senior citizens to be able to pay, we're going to have an accumulation of them paying. It's not the model we can do. I would urge them to perhaps encourage their children to teach them and help them pay online, which might be an easier and better way for any people involved in which to make those payments in that manner.
All right, thank you. I think we all now generally are in favour of government and making government more efficient. So I'd ask the Minister, in terms of these measures, some of which are emergency and some of which will probably envision may be rolled out over time, is it going to be the Minister now that for some public councils that are being closed, will not be reopened in the future, and that there will be a new way of government and doing business, as we've already started rolling out some of these rebound measures, if you want to feel that makes some councils redundant, or that they feel that you don't need to in some public councils. The reason why I ask this today is that there are some members of the public who have not yet brought. Well, I'm not talking about people in prison, I'm talking about ordinary people in the street. I've asked, when are the public councils going to reopen? I appreciate part of it will be part of the COVID on lockdown, but of course, we are now seeing more and more businesses opening, corporations, business, and not that it can be usual given the protection that are required for COVID. So I'm asking, is there an intention to open public councils that were open before, or will there be less?
Mr. Speaker, the provision of new government does not necessitate the opening of public funding. When I talk about good services, what we're doing is people to continue to provide those services, which we're not going to be able to bring to the revival of the computer exercise, immediately. Therefore, we are working content to deliver good services in order to ensure that we don't need to open public funding. One business of COVID and two businesses to our intention to have services run across the government service because we believe it is more efficient and we provide continuous with a far better service. And so, one of the questions is, we hope not to have to open up counter, one from the recruitment and people from the efficiency in terms of the service we're going to give. And we are therefore running our both the crew and the hospital crew in services as we speak. Question number 400 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. Ben Hassan Nam.
Can the government confirm who has governance of the Beach COVID app and who has access to this information and for how long?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Digital and Financial Services. These are all the questions going to questions 401 and 402. Question number 401 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M. Hassan Naam.
In the interest of promoting transparency and user confidence, can the government publish the data protection impact assessments carried out in respect of the Beach COVID to both the app and the activities of the Contact Tracing Bureau?
Question number 402. Of 2020, beyond with MD Hassan Naam.
While the government has said that the Beach COVID app does not process personal information, has the government assessed the risk of future de-identification as a consequence of technological advances, and is there a program to review the situation on a regular basis in order to mitigate such a risk?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Digital and Financial Services. The Beach COVID water app does not require a data protection impact assessment as we are not capturing or processing any personal data. The Beach COVID water app has been developed by the Digital Services Community Consultation and Trial Design Committee. We have also worked with Apple, Google, the Irish Government, and the technical team at Mayfair Limited. The app is completely anonymous. No personal data is logged or shared with anyone at any time. The app uses Bluetooth technology within the phone and the Apple Google API to track other phones you come into contact with. Any data captured by a phone is stored locally within each phone. The phone will hold a maximum 14 days worth of data. No one has access to the information held in each phone. If you have come into close contact within 2 meters to 15 minutes or more, if someone is tested positive for the virus, you will be notified via the app. This, again, is done automatically and completely anonymously. The government does not believe there is any risk for future technology disturbing the anonymity of the app, as we do not believe Google or Apple would permit such a change. And this is very much under their direct control.
Thank the Honourable Minister for his answer, but he hasn't answered the question as to whether a data protection impact assessment was actually carried out. Or maybe I misheard, but.
Because I think that the Beach COVID does not require a DPIO, as we are not capturing or processing any personal data.
Mr. Speaker, from my understanding, the data controller has to carry out a DPIA. When you bring out new technology or when there is a potential of high risk and also when there's large scale use of sensitive data. I understand that they don't have to publish it, but from my understanding it has to be carried out. But my question was mainly to ask about whether perhaps carrying one out and publishing it would achieve confidence in the product and feel confident that we can maximize the number of people using it and make the product more viable. So would publishing one not put people's minds at ease on bringing the confidence in the app and the Contact Tracing Bureau services?
The other member talks about data controllers and sensitive data and data processing. And the answer I've given says that we are not capturing or processing any personal data. So there is absolutely no need to carry out
a DPIA to be done, no personal data detected or processed. Therefore, the provisions to which he's referring do not apply to this act. We tried to make this as clear as we can at every possible juncture in talking about and encouraging people to use the app in the full knowledge, in the absolute full knowledge, that nobody's going to know who they are, where they are, there's no location on the app tracking where the individual is going. It is simply tracking if you come within 10 minutes of the phone for more than 15 minutes. And that's all that it reports. The number of that phone and the deep pump into your telephone, the unique code that the GHA will give you to positive, which will then notify anybody that falls within an ambit of within 2 meters for 15 minutes for more than the past 14 days. No name, no people, nobody looking or watching or reading or hearing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Therefore, to suggest that carrying out the DPIA would make people feel more comfortable, I suggest people don't understand what a DPIA is or what its purpose is, generally. And I fully understand that because it is in the beginning of the protection, as I have had to, it's difficult to understand what you need. But I can tell all of them that in respect of this app, there's absolutely no need to be done with zero absolute data being processed or controlled by the staff or anybody who might be involved with the app. And if there was, the first people that would stop it would be Apple and Google, who created the system on a decentralized basis to precisely avoid that problem arising.
The minister may or may have involved very long with the question, you know, the common knowledge as to how apps are developed. And where do you own the app itself? And are the developers, will they allow it onto the site or onto the platform as they do it? But who actually owns the deep end of the app?
Our app is open source. The IOS government app is open source, which means the technology behind it, and we didn't operate it, is made open source to be very, very public and good in doing it, that others can use it and share it to be the widely used for messages for the public health of the world. When you develop an app, you don't have to submit it to the place where that app is going to be downloaded from, Apple or Google. And so they then carry out their own checks to ensure that it is compliant with their own internal processes and procedures. They do their own security checks, their own breach checks, and all their checks happen a day for each one. One is quicker and better, I won't say publicly which one it is. But it is then available to be downloaded, people can download it, and people can use it. I think the interesting thing about this particular methodology is that because of the pandemic and the world crisis that we face with this pandemic, Apple and Google uniquely did this API that enabled one type of phone to recognize the other kind of phone, so an Apple phone with a Google machine. And they are the ones that then approached all these countries and said, we will support through an API between Apple and Google the apps that you need to know to develop. The UK wants to know a different route, or they centralized that, which is now abandoned, and we follow very much on the European model. So the app is open source, so the big change of all the app is our app, developed by us, so it's open source, which is wanted to be used by anyone who may choose to for the same company.
It's fair reference to Mr. Barber. Again, this is not my field, so I apologize. If I'm not familiar with jargon, but you can spell API name, and in terms of, I guess, the ownership and open source that I understand, but ultimately the controller of the app is the support development, which is what concerned that, and are there any changes to, the color on the download screen or whatever, that would be something that would be initiated by the support development as being effectively the ultimate controller of the app.
Developed by us and done by us, so everything is done by us.
the manner in which interface to the users is done. In terms of an example, I would basically a link between two databases, two providers, in this case Apple and Google, as a bridge between the two to enable interoperability from one to another. That's how an API link is between the two types of bridge. Question number 403 of 2020. The Honourable E.J. Bennett. The Speaker, can the government confirm the number of locally registered vehicles leaving Gibraltar via the land frontier between the periods 7th of June to the 9th of June 2020 and the 10th of June to the 17th of June 2020? Answer, the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister. The number of locally registered vehicles leaving Gibraltar by the land frontier in the period specified is as follows: 7th of June to 9th of June 2020, 1,421. 10th of June to 17th of June 2020, 11,643.
The 10th of June, 17th of June 2020, obviously that period reflects the effectiveness, if I'm remembering correctly, the reopening of our usual pathway to Spain via the land frontier to our cars. Is that right, Mr. Speaker?
Mr. Speaker, it is reflecting the level of unlocking in both of our own in the place in Spain.
I think that the minister may not have this answer to that. But I think we also have corresponding figures for entry of vehicles for the same period of non-Gibraltar registered vehicles, sorry, foreign vehicles.
Mr. Speaker, you need to ask the question of here. I don't have that information, we can make it up to the plan. But they just have one number.
Question number 404 of 2020. The Honourable R.M. Clinton. I think the government is why we need to negotiate with Mr. Fortress. Thank you, sir. Answer, the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, the government has not been negotiating to purchase for the past.
Question number 405 of 2020. The Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassan Nauri.
What happened with the site of the old KP5 hospital tender that was awarded in 2017 to build a private residential care home and assisted living accommodation?
Answer, the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, outline planning commitment for a private residential care home in the site of the old KP5 hospital was granted on the 15th of March 2019. And full-time commission was granted on the 20th of May, 2019. However, the Belfast has since indicated that they no longer wish to proceed with the project, and the government intends to issue another statement of interest for a site in due course.
Mr. Speaker, thank you to the Deputy Minister for that answer. Is the government looking to acquire another related project in healthcare or for the elderly that has been canceling that in, or is it opening up to any sort of venture?
Mr. Speaker, the assessment is probably followed the previous model, which is it is open to any use which is compatible with the area.
Mr. Speaker, I don't want to sound difficult sound here, but considering, I mean, we've been talking today about the need for dementia and sufferers and the elderly, is government keeping sort of at the forefront of this planning and expectation and demarcation areas in terms of fulfilling the priority towards the elderly? And is this a priority when looking in future for developments that have come up? Would it be a
future
priority?
Just to be on the same level, which is my area of responsibility, this is the provision of facilities for dementia is obviously a priority for the government. But not necessarily in relation to the particular site, although the government is certainly open to new proposals.
In terms of the origin of the 2017 position, is there any sort of thought on the government side as to this is a good use of the funds because specifically the government encouraged the use of the funds for that? And so there has been some involvement with the government.
When the expression of public information came out in the earlier report that the department had 17, if I remember correctly, it was open to all users. So it was a proposal made by an interested party, not necessarily a requirement of the expression of public
information. I presume the government's interest to do,
did appointed by the Prime Minister to the land. Now, retracted.
So, if I understand this correctly, the government effectively sold the land, and now then allowed the developer to bring it back and hold the land back. Is that correct? And why am I missing something in my understanding of the process? And that is a bit of a gap in my knowledge of how he built much better than paying the premium.
So, Mr. Speaker, did the government not keep the percentage of this transaction as a result of perhaps the developer being the entity that was, for lack of a better word, messing government around
Thank you.
The House will now adjourn from Tuesday the 14th of July at 3 p.m.